Hebrews, the 18th verse, and the title of it is, By Two Immutable Things. By Two Immutable Things. So let us give our attention to Brother George. We're going to approach this subject this afternoon sort of in a Bible study fashion. We have to get the contextual setting of these verses, I think, in order to really understand the definition of what the two immutable things are. And so for that reason, we will back up and consider the setting and what Paul is talking about when he makes this statement. We'll back up to the 13th verse of the 6th chapter. He said, For when God made promise to Abraham, because he could swear by no greater, he swore by himself, saying, Surely blessing I will bless thee, and multiplying I will multiply thee. And so after he had patiently endured, he obtained the promise. For men verily swear by the greater, and an oath for confirmation is to them an end of all strife. Now you know when you go through the scriptures, you'll find that God made some oaths, but very, very few. You find that God made an oath, as he meant, the one he mentions here to Abraham. We're going to consider that oath for a while this afternoon. He made an oath to David that of the fruit of his loins, the seed of promise, the Messiah, would come. He made an oath in another instance to the nation of Israel concerning their disobedience, and he swore an oath upon the fact that he would punish them for their disobedience. One or two other oaths in the scriptures. We'll touch on another one this afternoon. But as you go through the Bible, you'll find that God made very, very few oaths. And we find that where he did make an oath, it was because he had something important to say. He was trying to put authenticity to his word. Now, it might seem strange that God would have to speak to us or speak to human beings from the standpoint of an oath. God's word itself is the very essence of truthfulness, of veracity, of his purpose. And yet, we find that God uses this means of trying to emphasize to us certain features of his word by giving them to us or stating them in a form of an oath. Concerning the oath that he swore to Abraham, we find a reference to that way back in the book of Genesis. Some rather interesting features about that oath. God, first of all, made that oath to Abraham, first stated in the 12th chapter, and it was stated that if he would leave his land, the land that he of his fathers and the land that he dwelt in, which was Ur of Chaldees, and go into the land that he would show him, that he would bring him into, that he would make a promise to him. The promise being that he would bring forth a seed, and that in that seed all the families of the earth would be blessed. Paul talks about the fact that God confirmed this oath. And we find that there were really several confirmations of this oath. There was one very definite confirmation of it in the life of Abraham. We find that Abraham was greatly tested in connection with this oath, in connection with this promise, rather. He was 75 years old when the Lord first stated this to him, that he was going to have a seed. It seemed that it just wasn't going to happen in Abraham's life in a natural way. Sarah was the one that Abraham naturally expected that this seed would come forth from, that this child would be born from. And yet it just seemed impossible that Sarah could have any children. Finally, Abraham, after many years, having his faith tested, he decided that, well, maybe the Lord wanted him to do something about it. At least he was going to take some action and see if the Lord would approve it. And so he took a steward of his house. His name was Eliezer. And he told the Lord that he was going to consider this steward in his house as his heir. He was going to take him in, adopt him as a son, and make him his heir. Because he says, "Behold, thou hast given me no seed." It's interesting how the Lord pictured so many features of his plan in this waiting period of Abraham's life, waiting for this seed, waiting to see how the Lord was going to fulfill this promise of the seed. The Lord spoke to Abraham on this occasion. And every time we find that the Lord spoke to Abraham in connection with this promise or covenant, he did so by way of adding confirmation to it. In this particular instance, he had Abraham offer some sacrifices. He had him take a heifer 3 years old and a she-goat and a ram and two turtle doves, and he had Abraham prepare these as a sacrifice. And it says when night came and Abraham was in a deep sleep that the Lord spoke to Abraham. Out of Abraham was in a normal sleep. We find that in many instances in the scriptures where an angel of the Lord speaks to someone, that they're spoken of as being in a sleep. This is true in Daniel's case. It apparently is something that the Lord causes or maybe induces upon this one so that their mind can really concentrate and grasp all that is said or all that is envisioned. Says that a deep sleep of great darkness fell upon him. And the Lord said to Abraham, of course, not only was this promise concerning the seed of interest to Abraham, but connected with that, of course, was the promise that his seed would occupy the land that the Lord had brought Abraham to. And Abraham didn't occupy that land. He didn't own any of it. Paul refers to that fact in the 11th chapter of Hebrews in a very interesting way. He says that it was by faith that Abraham sojourned in the land of promise as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, which were heirs of him in the same promise. He says that the Lord never gave any of that land to Abraham in his time, that it was strictly on the basis of faith that he expected or hoped, anticipated the Lord fulfilling this promise, that he dwelt in tents on that land. And you know, when you stop to realize some other aspects of Abraham's life, you get a little better picture of the importance that Abraham had in his life. We begin to realize how great his faith was. He believed that the Lord was going to give that land to him. You know, he could have taken it. He could have gone out and taken that land. Abraham, apparently, was a fairly powerful man in his day. We have little inklings of that in the history of Abraham. Remember on one occasion that there was a war that went on between five kings that came down from the north. They allied themselves together and they came down from the north and they made war with the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah and two other kings. As a matter of fact, I think for a period of 12 years they were sort of vacillated to these kings, and finally they got together and decided that they were going to free themselves from the influence of these other kings, and they made war. And the king of Sodom and the king of Gomorrah, it says they fell into slime pits, and their armies were without leadership, and they scattered, and these invading kings won the battle. They went into Sodom and Gomorrah, and they sacked those cities and some of the other cities around there, took all the people captive. Lot was among them, because Lot was living in Sodom, and his household was among them. Carried them all back captive. Well, one of the servants of Lot freed himself, escaped, and he came back down into the plains of Mamre, where Abraham was living. Still owned none of that land. He just dwelt there, as Paul says, as a stranger. And he came back, he found Abraham, and told Abraham what had happened. You know what Abraham did? He took his servants. I forget how many it was. It was around 200, I think, 169 or something like that, of his servants. And he armed them, and he went after the armies of five kings with all their captives, and he routed them. Probably took them by surprise, but he routed them nevertheless, took back all the captives and all the goods and returned them. Abraham was a fairly powerful man in his own right. A man with that amount of power, he could have gone in there and taken that land if he had wanted to. We have another instance where Abraham is addressed by the sons of Heth. I think it's in the 23rd chapter of Genesis. And this is where he was negotiating with them for just enough land to bury Sarah and himself. This was the time of Sarah's death. And in the course of these negotiations, this was a statement that was made by the sons of Heth to Abraham. It's the sixth verse of the 23rd chapter. He says, "Hear us, my lord, thou art a mighty prince among us." They recognized that Abraham was a prince among them. He was a ruler in his own right that had no country. He had no land. Abraham was a guest in the home of Pharaoh. He was a guest in the home of the king of the Philistines. He was on speaking terms with the king of Sodom and Gomorrah. He was on speaking terms with one called Melchizedek, who was priest of the Most High God. Abraham was thought of by these men as a ruler in his own right. And yet Abraham made no motions to acquire any of that land himself, because God had told him that he would give him that land. It says, "By faith he sojourned in the land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles." He says, "For he looked for a city without foundations." Of course, a city in those times was a government. And it says that he looked for a permanent home. He looked for a city who had foundations, whose builder and maker is God. He believed that in some way or another, and of course we're not sure just what scope of knowledge that God had, or Abraham had, of all that was implied in this promise that he made to him about his seed being the blessing all the families of the earth. But he thought of it in terms of a government that the Lord was going to establish on the earth, through which other peoples and governments would be blessed. And he thought of it in terms of the land that the Lord had brought him to, in which he sojourned as a stranger. He says that faith, Sarah shared the same faith with him, that Sarah, through faith, also herself received strength to conceive seed. He mentions a little later on that all these died in faith. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Sarah, all these died in faith, not having received the promises, especially as far as that land was concerned, because back here in Exodus, where we were considering about the Lord talking to Abraham at the time that he told him that he had made a servant of his household an heir, the Lord told Abraham at that time that this wasn't the way he intended that this matter of the seed would be fulfilled. And he, of course, at this time, he made a covenant with Abraham. And the covenant was based upon these animal sacrifices that he had Abraham prepare. And during the night, why, of course, the Lord consumed these sacrifices, it says that there was something that appeared to be like a burning furnace that went in between the pieces and the parts of this sacrifice. And, of course, we assume that it consumed the sacrifice that Abraham had made. But when he made that covenant with Abraham, he made this statement. He said to Abraham, "Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. He was telling Abraham, he says, that it's going to be yet 400 years before any of your seed is going to occupy any of this land. That was a long time for Abraham to look down into the future. And it says, "In the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, unto thy seed have I given this land." And this was the way that he made that covenant, by having these sacrifices prepared. And you know, this became a custom among the Jews, and it's not known whether the custom originated because God started it with Abraham here, or whether God did it here because it was already a custom. But it was a custom for men back in those days when they made covenants, when they swore oaths to one another, to offer sacrifices in connection with them. And those sacrifices was supposed to represent their very life being hinged upon them keeping that their part of that covenant. Paul makes an allusion to that later on in Hebrews, but we won't have time to get into that because it's kind of a long subject. Oaths were very, very important. They're still important. This was a way that men had of verifying their word. And the custom has come right on down to us today. When someone goes to court today, as a witness in court, they have to place their hand upon the Bible and swear to tell the truth. It's an oath. If they perjure themselves in court, they're guilty of an infraction of law, and they can be sentenced. That's how important oaths are. It was a means that was formed back in those olden days by which people could be made responsible for the covenants, for the contracts, for the things that they said that they were going to do. God, in confining himself to a statement of an oath, was making himself responsible to what he said he was going to do in that covenant. At this particular time, he even outlined somewhat the dimensions of this land. He said, "Unto thy seed I have given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates." And then he mentions the various tribes that lived on that land. And when we look them all up, we find that all of these lived on a narrow strip of land, all the way from the Euphrates River in the north, as it flowed up along the borders of Lebanon, down along the coast of the Mediterranean, and to the River of Egypt, which most historians agree was a river that flowed through the middle of the Sinai Peninsula. A small stream that is only there during a portion of the year. But that can be verified by some things that decrees that, especially one that Solomon made. Later on, we find other statements of the delimitations of this land, and we find that they agree with, he outlined it to Moses, he outlined it again to, Joshua spoke of the limitations, the limits of this land, before they crossed over the Jordan to go into it, and they were crossing over from the east. The Jordan River seemed to be the eastern dimension of this land. Paul tells us, in connection with the seed feature of that promise, that Abraham was required to exercise great faith in that. You remember how that later on, when he found out that the Lord wouldn't accept the servant of his household, that later on, through the insistence of Sarah, he took Hagar into his household as a wife and bore Ishmael. Of course, the Lord told Abraham that this wasn't the way that he intended that this seed was going to be fulfilled. But we find that the Lord, in the lives of Hagar, in the lives of Ishmael, made a lot of detail, prefigured a lot of history that would relate to the nation of Israel under their law covenant. And Paul defines that quite graphically, quite detailed for us in the book of Galatians. Here was Abraham was attempting to fulfill the covenant that the Lord made with him in a way that wasn't acceptable to the Lord. And you know, the nation of Israel had the same concept concerning the law. He says that Ishmael represented the nation that was brought forth under the law covenant, which was Hagar. They had that same erroneous concept of the law because they thought that the law covenant was going to be the means by which the Lord would fulfill the Abrahamic promise to them. That it was through the law covenant that all the families of the earth would be blessed. Paul has quite a bit to say about that in the 10th, 11th chapter of Romans, especially the 9th and the 10th chapters, rather. Well, eventually, after 25 years of waiting, why the Lord did bring forth the seed in his own way, through a miracle. Sarah was unable to have children naturally, but the Lord performed a miracle and Sarah brought forth Isaac. How beautifully it pictured the fact that he who Isaac represented would also be brought forth in a miraculous fashion. Well, this child grew, and you can imagine how Abraham must have felt about Isaac, a child that was brought forth by the Lord, as far as he was concerned. And after several years of tenderly raising this child and thinking of him in terms of in the future, through him, these promises that the Lord had made, being fulfilled. Remember, the Lord asked Abraham to sacrifice him. You can imagine how Abraham felt. However, there's no indication that Abraham ever questioned it with God. It seems incredible almost that someone could be asked to do something like that, to sacrifice their own son, especially one that was as important to Abraham as Isaac was. His whole life almost was wrapped up in the promises that the Lord had made through him, and here was the heir of those promises. I sometimes wonder if the Lord didn't do it this way to try to give us, we can sympathize with Abraham, try to give us some idea of how he felt in having to give his only begotten son in order that the world might be saved through them, in order that this Abrahamic promise might indeed have a rich and wonderful fulfillment at a later date in the times of restitution of all things. We can sympathize with Abraham. It gives us some little idea of how God helped through having to do this, and yet he wanted to show us the great importance that he placed upon the working out of all of the great attributes of his character and the various features of his plan. He didn't spare himself. But probably there's no record of Abraham ever questioning God on this, because he didn't. And the reason he didn't is stated by Paul. He says, by faith Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac, and he that received the promise offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said that in Isaac shall thy seed be called. And here was the reason why there's no record of Abraham questioning God on the matter, accounting that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead, from whence he received him in a figure. The Lord realized that, or Abraham realized that the Lord had brought Isaac into the world in a miraculous way, that if he was required to sacrifice him, Abraham was a believer in the resurrection of the dead. And he believed that God would raise up Isaac from the dead in order to fulfill that promise, to honor his promise. For men verily swear by the greater, and an oath for a confirmation is to them an end of all strife. The Lord wanted Abraham to, he wanted Abraham to have full assurance. He didn't want there to be any doubt. And maybe it wasn't really so much for on Abraham's account that he stated it in the form of an oath. We know that he actually stated that oath after Abraham had shown how great his faith was by being willing to offer up Isaac. And then it was that the Lord stated, he says, by myself have I sworn, saith the Lord, that in blessing I will bless thee, and multiplying I will multiply thee. That was the time that the Lord confirmed it by an oath. Now he says, wherein God willing more abundantly to show unto the heirs of the promise the immutability of his counsel, confirmed it by an oath. Paul tells us who the heirs of the promise are. Again, in the book of Galatians, in just one simple statement, this is the third chapter in the 29th verse, and if ye be Christ, then are ye Abraham's seed, and heirs according to the promise. Paul says here that God willing more abundantly to show unto the heirs of this promise, and that includes you and me today, the immutability of his counsel, and that's the reason he declared it to Abraham. He wanted to declare to Abraham the immutability of his counsel, how unchangeable it was, even though he tested Abraham severely in connection with having it fulfilled. He confirmed it by an oath, that by two immutable things in which it was impossible for God to lie. Now, he's told us about one immutable thing in which it was impossible to God to lie, and that's what an oath was, as far as man was concerned. God condescended to express his immutability in terms that man would understand, especially fallen man. That by two immutable things, one of them was the oath that he made to Abraham. That was an immutable thing, an immutable statement of his purpose. I've heard many ideas suggested as to what the immutable things were. I've heard it suggested that it's impossible for God to lie and that it's impossible for God to deny himself, but that's not what the statement says here. It says by two immutable things in which it was impossible for God to lie. By virtue of the way it was stated, because it was an oath. I've heard it stated that it was the promise that God made to Abraham was one immutable thing, and later the confirmation of it was the other immutable thing. But I suppose we all have maybe our own ideas of what the two immutable things are, but I think Paul defines what this other immutable thing is, if we go on. He says that to us he has given another immutable thing above and beyond that which he stated to Abraham, that we might have strong consolation who have fled for refuge to lay hold upon the hope that is set before us. That's the reason he gave it to Abraham, so he could lay hold on that hope. Which hope we have as an anchor of the soul, both sure and steadfast, in which entereth into that which is within the veil. He says that the summation of our hope, or what was represented within the veil of the tabernacle, sort of summed up the important features of what our hope really is. Of course, Paul goes on in Hebrews here to tell us that what was represented by the Most Holy, the tabernacle, was heaven itself. That's part of our hope. It's a spiritual hope. Within the Most Holy, the tabernacle, there dwelt the presence of God. And this was manifest there, represented there, of course, as we so often hear it described by His attributes. And after all, that's the way God has really expressed Himself to us, is by His attributes. Moses wanted to see God, and the Lord told Moses that no man could see Him and live, but he gave him a little glimpse of His glory. And He's done the same thing with us. He's given us a little glimpse of His glory through an understanding of His plan. But He knew that just seeing His glory and His majesty, which surrounds us in creation itself, that this wasn't really enough to express God, to express Himself to Moses. And so He declared Himself to Moses as he went by. The Lord God, merciful, abundant in goodness and truth, forgiving iniquity, but who will in no wise clear the guilty. And so God has expressed Himself to us in just the same way. He's declared Himself to us in just the same way. Through His Word, we've come to understand what God stands for. What the ruling principles of His life, of His being, of His character, of His kingdom, of His rulership are. And these we sort of sum up in four great attributes, don't we? And they were represented there in the Holy of the Tabernacle by the mercy seat, representing the justice of God as it was represented through Christ, prepared as a propitiation for our sins, and not only for our sins, but the sins of the whole world. And the word propitiation means a mercy seat. The two angels, the two cherubims, of course, representing God's love and God's And of course, we say the Shekinah glory completes this picture with the wisdom and the light of God overall. And so part of our hope is coming into the very presence, into the very being, or being in the very presence of such a God. And of course, in order to be in the presence of a God, such a God, requires being made in His likeness, doesn't it? Other things that were represented, that were there in the Most Holy of the Tabernacle, which represent features of our hope, was the Ark of the Covenant, over which the mercy seat was the lid of that Ark. And of course, that Ark of the Covenant pictures Christ, the entire Christ, as the way in which God's great attributes will be manifest to the world in His kingdom. And inside that ark were three other things that represented various features of our hope. There was placed in that Ark of the Covenant, first of all, there was Aaron's rod that budded, had some very deep significance because it was placed in there as a result of a rebellion that developed, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, that they questioned the leadership of Moses, and of course the Lord destroyed them, but they could never question the leadership of Moses as they did without having quite a bit of support from other people. There probably was quite a bit of murmuring that was going on about Moses maybe taking too much authority on himself, and not only Moses, but the whole Levitical tribe. And so the Lord had, in order to settle this issue, And he said that he wasn't leaving, he was indicating to the children of Israel that he wasn't leaving it up to them as to who was going to be their priests and who was going to be their leaders, that he was the one who selected and chose and elected as far as the priesthood was concerned, as far as those who would represent him, as far as his spokesmen were concerned. And so he had the chief of each tribe, the head of each tribe, give Moses his rod, and among them was the rod of Aaron. They laid them up before the mercy seat in front of the Ark of the Covenant in the most holy of the tabernacle overnight, and the next morning Aaron brought out these rods. None of them had changed except Aaron's. But Aaron's rod had budded, and it brought forth blossoms, and it had fruited. And thus it was that the Lord unquestionably indicated who was his exclusive choice to officiate as Israel's priesthood. And he put that in the Ark of the Covenant. It was kept there. Another thing that went in that Ark of the Covenant was a golden pot of manna. Now we get over into the of course, manna was the means by which Israel was sustained in the wilderness. And the peculiar thing about manna was that it didn't last, that it would last one day. And so they only could gather enough for one day, because any that was kept over, it spoiled. Unless it was kept over the Sabbath, and then the Lord, in his providence, would allow it to keep one more day. They had to gather enough for 2 days prior to the Sabbath. But over in the book of Revelation, there's mentioned the fact that, and it has to do with one of the promises, defining part of our hope, mentioned the fact that there was some manna that was gathered, and it was put in a golden pot, and it was put in the Ark of the Covenant, in the most holy of the tabernacle, and that manna never corrupted. It never went bad. And this promise, this is alluded to in one of the promises in Revelation, where it says, "To him that overcometh will I give to eat of the hidden manna." That was the hidden manna. It was hidden in that ark. And it was a representation of everlasting life, of immortal life, because it was contained within a golden pot. And golden things in the tabernacle represented things divine. There was another thing that was put in that ark, and that was the two tables of the law. Paul tells us in Corinthians, I believe, 2 Corinthians, the third chapter, that the tables of the law were given by Moses for the purpose of instructing the people of Israel concerning God's law. These were the basic principles of the law. Yes, the third chapter of 2 Corinthians. And here Paul makes sort of a contrast. He says that we now are having the law of God written in our hearts for the same purpose that the law of God was written in those two tables of the law and given to Moses for the purpose of teaching the people. He says, "For as much as ye are manifestly declared to be the epistles of Christ, ministered by us, written not with ink, but by the Spirit of the living God, not in tables of stone, but in the fleshy tables of the heart, and such trust we have through Christ to Godward, who hath made us able ministers of the New Testament," or the New Covenant. That's the purpose of having the law of God written in our hearts now by the Spirit of God. All that was represented in that law of God. It's interesting to realize that there's a contrast in the way that law of God is written It was written to the nation of Israel in a very negative way, because the Lord was speaking to people through that law who were alienated from him. People who couldn't really come to a full appreciation of God's law from a perfect point of view or from a positive point of view. It was a thou shalt not proposition. Every one of the of those commandments was prefaced by thou shalt, or there was a negative statement in it, or thou shalt not. Interestingly enough, when Jesus was questioned about the law and which of these was the greatest commandment, he looked at it as a perfect man would have looked at the law of God, and from a very positive point of view. He says that there is no really greatest commandment. He says that they're all summed up in these two commandments, thou shalt love the Lord thy God. Very positive approach. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, thy soul, and thy mind. And the second is like unto this, unto the first, and thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. That's the kind of law that we're having written in our hearts in a very positive fashion, in a very positive way, for the purpose of being able to teach God's law through a new covenant arrangement. Jesus had something else to say concerning this law way back there when he gave his Sermon on the Mount. And there he sort of contrasted our appreciation of the law with the strict, very strict definition of the law as it was given to Israel. And there, you remember, he said that it said in the law, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and a man's life for a man's life, and so on. And he expressed it in that fashion. But he said, but I say unto you, and he told us that our approach to the law should go much further than just that strict adherence to the checks and balances of justice. He says, I say unto you that you should do good to those that despitefully use you, that you should pray for them. That was never required in the law, was it? And so, our hope, part of our hope that was represented in that which was within the veil, was our future position as priests of God, being elected by God to that position. That election is now. Having the Holy Spirit right in our hearts through a lifetime of dedication to His Word, and service to His Word, right in our hearts, the perfect law of God, and our hope to be able to administer that law in the grand and glorious way that the Christ will administer it, as Paul explains later, a priesthood that had life, an everlasting priesthood, divine life, a priesthood that had power. Now, and Paul goes on to express it in just that way. He says in the 20th verse, whither the forerunner is entered, for us is entered. He's talking about heaven itself, or this which is represented beyond the veil, even Jesus, made an high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. It's a rather strange expression. You know, Melchizedek, while the Lord is making all of this great detail of picture in the life of Abraham, nobody ever would, in reading the life of Abraham, would ever really give much importance to Melchizedek, because there are just three verses that incidentally mention him and describe him for us. And that's when Abraham returned from this getting back the spoils that these five kings had taken and the captives. And the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah and these other kings, they came out to bargain with Abraham and to claim that which was theirs. And it incidentally mentions on that occasion that Melchizedek, who it describes as the priest of Salem, this is the 14th chapter of Genesis, it says, "And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God, and he blessed him and said, Blessed be Abraham of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be the Most High God, which hath delivered thine enemies into thy hand, and Abraham gave him tithes of all." That's all it stated about Melchizedek. All the vast detailed picture he made about Abraham in connection with the oath that he made to Abraham, and that's all he says about Melchizedek. But Paul goes on in the 7th chapter to tell us that Melchizedek was a very, very important person. He himself was a very, very important picture as far as God was concerned. And the only reason Paul could make that statement is because there's only one other mention of Melchizedek in the Old Testament, prophetically, and it's in the 110th Psalm. But it definitely indicates that Melchizedek was a type. And the setting here is the setting of Jesus, not while he was on earth, but after his resurrection. After his resurrection to power, as Paul says, who hath entered, our forerunner who has entered for us, now sitting at the right hand of the Lord, begins, "The Lord said unto my Lord, Sit thou on my right hand till I make thine enemies thy footstool. The Lord shall send the rod of thy strength out of Zion, rule thou in the midst of thine enemies." This new position of power and rulership that was given to Jesus. And it goes down to into the fourth verse. He describes in the third verse some of the things that will be accomplished as a result of the exercise of his power. And it seems to describe there the fact that seems to be descriptive of some features of the kingdom. He says, "And thy people shall be willing in the day of thy power." The day when his power is exercised during the reign of righteousness on the earth, in the beauties of holiness from the womb of the morning. Saying that how that the womb of the morning will bring birth to the beauties of holiness in that kingdom, thou hast the due of thy youth. And he says the reason this could all be accomplished through his power, and will be accomplished through his power, is because the Lord swore an oath. Another oath that the Lord swore. "The Lord has sworn and will not repent. Thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." And I submit that this is the second immutable thing that Paul is talking about. The oath that was sworn in connection with this Melchizedek type. For he goes on in the 7th chapter, and he says this. He describes this Melchizedek. He describes how great he was as far as his contrast with the Levitical priesthood that came, of course, according to the law, which was in the loins of Abraham in the form of Levi at the time that Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek. He says, "For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God." One of the things that was in that Ark of the Covenant was Aaron's rod that budded, which showed God's authenticity or God's authority in the selection of his priesthood. And this Melchizedek is mentioned as priest of the Most High God, designated by God. He goes on to describe some other important features of him. We're going to have to go quickly over it. We'll skip down to the 6th verse. "But he whose descent is not counted from them that received tithes to Abraham, and blessed him that had the promises. For he was yet in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him." And here, of course, he's he's contrasting the greatness of this Melchizedek priesthood in comparison with the Levitical priesthood. The Levitical priesthood, of course, officiated over the old law covenant arrangement and was for that purpose. But he says that this new priesthood, this Melchizedek priesthood, is for a new law arrangement. He says, and for that reason, the law has to change. He says, for the priesthood being changed, there is a necessity, a change also of the law. Now, he's not saying that the principles of the law change, but he's saying that the covenant arrangement of that law, it necessitates a change. And he goes on to describe this priesthood in these words. He says, who is made not after the law of a carnal commandment, but after the power of an endless life. He's going on to show, he's showing how the Levitical priesthood was weak, and that those priests were men of like passions as others, that they were fallen, that they were under condemnation, that they died, that they were powerless in that sense. But he says that this new priesthood, not after the law of a carnal commandment, but after the power of an endless life, that golden pot of manna, divine life, the most powerful life that there is, that exists. For he testified, thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. And he goes on further describing this Melchizedek. He says, for the law made nothing perfect, but the bringing in of a better hope did, by which we draw nigh unto God. And inasmuch as not without an oath he was made a priest. Now here Paul is emphasizing the fact that Melchizedek, and Jesus is the representation of that Melchizedek priesthood, at least that part of the priesthood who had preceded as a forerunner and had already entered into heaven, he says, and inasmuch as it was not without an oath that he was made a priest, he's emphasizing the fact that the Lord attached his oath to that priesthood. He says, for those priests were made without an oath. He's talking about the Aaronic priesthood again. But this with an oath, by him that said unto him, the Lord swear and will not repent, thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. By so much was Jesus made the surety of a better testament, by two immutable things, by these two oaths in which it was God was expressing to us the fact that he could not lie, the oath that he made to Abraham, and the way that that was going to be fulfilled. Some thought it was going to be fulfilled through the law covenant. Not so. He says it was going to be fulfilled through that which Melchizedek pictured, this great Melchizedek priesthood that he attached his oath to. For they truly were many priests, because they were not suffered to continue by reason of death. But this man, because he continueth ever, hath an unchangeable priesthood, wherefore he is able to save them to the uttermost that come unto him by God, seeing he ever liveth to make intercession for us. For such an high priest became us, who is holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, and made higher than the heavens. And this is the priest which the new law covenant will be entrusted, the one that will administer that new law. And that's the reason it's so vital to have that law and the spirit of that law written in the hearts of those who are going to be members of this priesthood. He said, who needeth not daily, as those high priests, to offer up sacrifice, first for his own sins and then for the people's, for this he did once when he offered up himself. For the law maketh men high priests which have infirmity, but the word of the oath which was since the law, another reference to the Melchizedek oath, the word of the oath before the law was the Abrahamic oath, the oath he put on the Abrahamic promise. But he says the word of the oath which was since the law maketh the Son who is consecrated forevermore. Now the things which we have spoken, this is the sum. We have such an high priest who is set on the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. a minister of the sanctuary of the true tabernacle, not the one that the Lord had pitched by human hands, of the true tabernacle, which the Lord has been raising up throughout this entire gospel age, which the Lord pitched and not man, wherein God, willing more abundantly to show unto the ears of the promise the immutability of his counsel, confirmed it by an oath, that by two immutable things, the oath he swore to Abraham and the oath that he swore in connection with Melchizedek, who was to carry out and fulfill the Abrahamic promise, which it was impossible for God to lie, we might have strong consolation who have fled for refuge to lay hold upon the hope that is set before us.
Well, I would like to thank Brother George Ike for that very inspiring discourse. I'd like to thank all the speakers who spoke today from this platform. We've had a spiritual feast of fat things, much deep spiritual food, which we can all take home with us, food for thought, and we can build upon these things which have been spoken from the platform today. I'd like to also thank not only the speakers today, but all those who helped out with the young adults meetings and the children's classes. The speakers have sent their love from their various ecclesias, and I know we would like to, as a congregation of the Lord's people, return our love to the speakers, to their various classes, and to all the various ecclesias that are represented here. All those who like to do so, please do so by raising your hand. So you each have a individual burden to bring back, a burden of love to your own ecclesia. We have not only had a spiritual feast of spiritual food, but after the closing hymn and the closing prayer, we, our ecclesia, all invite you downstairs for some temporal food to take you on your journey back home. And we have plenty of food and leftover chicken, and we have pizza. And even if you're not hungry, please come down and have fellowship with us and break bread together with us.